The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Kieran Fallon, one of the greatest jockeys we've ever had in this country, is with us. He has written his autobiography. But I want to start with the horse racing. And what was the greatest day in your professional career?
I'm not saying, but there's so many great days, you know, from riding my first winner to one of my favourite horses was Dylan Thomas. And every time I got on him, I'll never forget the first time I rode him. You know, there've been so many great days. Getting the job with Henry Cecil, you know, that was like.
But was there not one outstanding win that, you know, you've had many great victories, but was there just one day that, above all, that was the win to beat them all?
Islington in the Breeders' Cup, and I'd have to say a Ouija board in the, you know, either of them, because I love America. I love riding there. It was different, you know. It was like magic, and Islington went in the Breeders' Cup where I learned. We really learned to ride, and I went to America to learn the clock, and that would definitely be for
me. Okay, explain that to me when you say to learn the clock, and also what difference is there in American flat racing to what we have over here in Ireland and Britain?
A little bit different. Their tracks are very, very different in sense to go. They just go left-handed. You only got two turns to an extent. Saint-Denis is a little bit different because you got a 6.5 down the hill, but there's not many races that run down there. But it's all about timing and speed, you know. I don't know how I'm going to explain it. Other than it's like driving a car without looking at the speedometer. You have to know how quick you're going. In racing, you have to know how quick you're going. And for the layman, it would be knowing whether you're in a 30 miles an hour zone or a 40 or a 60, and knowing how quick and without looking at the speedometer.
That's actually, I hadn't thought of it like that, but it makes perfect sense because you actually have to be able to judge and gauge. It's different to when you're running because you know yourself, possibly your own lung capacity.
Yes, exactly.
But if you're on a horse, you're judging the pace that all the horses are going at.
Yeah, brilliant.
And do they actually tend to go faster in the States because of the type of track?
They do, yeah. It's usually a fast surface. It's fast level track. On the dirt, it's the same. You know, they can't go quick enough on the dirt because of the kickback. They want to get out of that. A lot of horses don't like to face the kickback. And they don't seem to go faster, but they go faster earlier on. We tend to, a bit like the French, start steadier to finish. But when the two meet up, it's funny because, you know, it you can get a different result.
How do the American jockeys take to the Irish jockeys coming over to be part of their big races?
They're friendly, you know. Obviously, they don't like you to win on their doorstep, but they are friendly. And, you know what, it's like golfers meeting up, you know, like, you know, Rory going to America. You know, it's just the same thing. It's nice and it's competitive and they all enjoy it. It's the same way with racing.
You're about 18 months out of it now, is it?
Something like that, yeah.
How are you coping with that?
Not good at the start, but it helped me doing the book because I was able to look back over my life, you know, and it helped me to get out of the kind of the darker days that, you know, I wasn't enjoying.
But they say an awful lot of professional sports people, when they retire, they struggle to cope with the actual change in circumstances. Retired, it's different to being out because of injury or out of suspension. It's knowing that you're actually finished. But you also gave up at a time when you were having issues with depression. So how are you now? How are you able to cope with that?
I'm good now. I mean, I was lucky enough, actually, that because I didn't know what was wrong, but I knew there was something wrong when I was in America. And actually, my last couple of years riding in England, I wasn't happy and I wasn't comfortable. And it wasn't until I came back home here to Ireland and I had to do medical. And Dr. Aldrin McGoldrick, who is the chief medical doctor of the Turf Club, and he was the one, you know, when speaking to him and, you know, just going through, he's a man you can talk to, you know. And I was surprised because I'd done a lot of tests, and all sorts of blood tests, everything, and could find nothing wrong. Everything was perfect, but we didn't know. And it wasn't until he said, we started talking about the court case and now the Old Bailey trial and all. He said, you probably haven't got over that, which I probably hadn't, you know.
Sort of a post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
For those who aren't familiar with it, and you explain it in the book, and I'm sure lots of people will go to read it in the book, but tell us a little bit about the court case that you got caught up in.
Well, I was accused of defrauding the bet, what they call the Betfair public. They had a new betting.
So it's race fixing, effectively, was it?
Race fixing, yeah. Well, to an extent, race fixing, yeah.
Which you were innocent of?
I was innocent. I was never involved in any of it. It was just... it was an owner, an ex-owner that was laying horses that was talking to jockeys. What do you call collateral damage?
Yeah.
And they brought a body of a new body into the, what they call the jockey club, the BHA, the old jockey club. And they decided they were going to try and clean up racing because of a panorama program that said that the BHA, they didn't have any backbone and they weren't doing their job right. A guy called next city, a London policeman called Paul Scottney, came in and he said he would clean up racing. And I happened to be on the radar of the BHA with an incident that I had with a different jockey. I had a fight, and then in Hong Kong they said I was involved with triads. So, you know, for him it looked as if I should be someone that should be as of interest.
And of course you also were targeted at times by the News of the World, and that infamous fake sheikh was a guy as well who targeted you as one of his victims.
Yeah, he was in jail now for falsely making allegations, and to a lot of people, you know.
But when you were undergoing that trial, even if you knew you were innocent, how fearful were you that there might be things brought up that would make you appear to be guilty, and that a jury might decide you were guilty and that you could be wrongfully convicted?
Well, the only thing I knew, I had nothing to worry about. And when we got arrested, I think they made some 16 arrests. I obviously had to have a solicitor when I was being questioned. And my solicitor said to me, he said, "You don't have to answer any questions, you know, just no comment." I said, "I have nothing to hide." I said, "I don't even know why I'm in here," which I didn't know I was there. They started asking me about different names, Miles Rogers, Fergal Lynch, Darren Williams, which were two jockeys I knew. They were probably the only two I knew on the list. And it really all started from there, you know. I mean, I was to go into it. It took 3.5 years to get to the Old Bailey, and then 9 weeks in the Old Bailey for something I shouldn't have been there for.
But of course, it also ruined the final years of your career to an extent, didn't it?
Completely, yeah. I was never the same after.
And for all the time that you missed as well, because you were suspended while the case was ongoing.
Yeah, I was able to ride in Ireland, you know, the turf club here granted me a licence. They looked at it like innocent and proven guilty, whereas in England they wouldn't. They changed some of their rules before I got charged. This was the ongoing investigation. If I was charged, and it changed the rule a couple of weeks before then, so.
So then, you know, sort of the feeling, I mean, I would imagine a certain degree of relief after you had been acquitted, but was there anger as well?
I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I was in not a very good place. I remember coming out of the Old Bailey, meaning, like, even though there was no evidence, and there was no shred of evidence, and not in the shred of evidence, with no case to answer, it was still hard for her to face all the trainers that had to come to the Old Bailey to say that they were their instructors. There was nothing wrong with the rides, but it's still a horrible place to be, you know. It's like accused of something that you didn't do, but if you have to go and defend yourself, and you're never the same. It's never going to be the same, even though you're proven innocent. A lot of people, they look at you in a different light.
And what help have you had since? Because when you retired, you did say it was abrupt because of depression. Have you had clinical help as a result?
Yeah, I spent 4 weeks in St. Pat's. Even before I went to St. Pat's, Dr. Adrian McGoldrick helped me on medication, which it is hard because you're not allowed to really ride. Jockeys aren't allowed to ride on any medication, on less extreme circumstances. So I was lucky enough that I had a great doctor.
Do you think that the depression, and obviously the court case had a major part to play in it, but the physical toll that your body had to take during your career, would that perhaps have been a factor as well? Because one of the things that's extraordinary in the book is about your eating disorder. And what weight are you now, can I ask you?
I put on a lot of weight, so I have about 9 stone.
Okay, that's not a lot of weight, is it?
It isn't comfortable for me, because I would never ever, even when I wasn't riding, you know, I would never let my weight go above 8.7, 8.5, 8.6 up to 8.7. That'd be, if I went to 8.8, I'd be, you know.
But hang on, that's an unnaturally low level for most men, isn't it?
But if you're fit and.
Yeah, but you went to exceptional extremes to keep your weight down.
Yeah, but that was for my work. There's a big difference. If you can't make the scale, it means you can't go to work. And if you can't make the lighter, if you can make all the weights, it means it opens up more doors for you. Whereas the likes of Adam Kirby, you know, and them boys are riding today, that they can't do any lighter than 9 stone. There's a lot of races that they can't ride in. But I was lucky enough that I was able to keep it down. But it took me a long time to get it down and stabilize it.
But the stories in the book are remarkable of the things that you had to do. I mean, just tell listeners a little bit about how you would layer up in the mornings before going for a run, and then drive to a race with the heating turned up in the car. Just what would you have been wearing?
Well, even before racing, we'd often in the morning, when you go up in the morning, so it was fine during, but it was only a summer thing. Then we only had racing from March to November. It's not like today where you have just the 1st of January till the end of December. The all-weather racing is 24 hours now. But back then it was only March, so it's summertime. You could wake up in the morning and put on, well, I used to put on, you know, the old long johns and the polo neck, and then we have the plastic suits, you know, like the boiler suits.
Yeah.
And you'd stick some jumpers on, the jacket, and you could ride out like that. Very uncomfortable. I didn't like that. I didn't mind as much when I get back, you know, when I didn't ride out in the morning, because you'd like to be, you know, because when you're too many clothes riding out, it's very uncomfortable. But when I get back after riding out, sometimes I do the same thing, put the long johns on, plastic suits, track suits. You go for a 2, 3, or 4 mile run, play squash for maybe for 10, 15 minutes just to get the sweat, jump in the car. Obviously, during the summer, you know, you wouldn't have to put on the heaters, just the heat of the car. And you could drive. Catrick was great because it was only 40 minutes away, or you could be an hour in Newcastle. But the farthest one I had to go was Ayr. I remember going to Ayr one day, I'll never forget as long as I live, for 3.5 hours.
Sweating.
I didn't think I was going to make it. And you'd obviously, what you had to do is you let the window down just a little bit, it didn't, just let some air in so you could breathe, you know. But when you start sweating like that, you couldn't stop, because obviously you get like, it'd be like a cold sweat, and you'd stop sweating then. You had to wait till you got to the course, which is, you know, severe.
And of course, you're not eating really. You go and have, a cup of tea with a spoon of sugar in it.
Loads of sugar. I lived on sugar. You know, I don't, people say sugar is bad for you and salt, but without sugar, I probably wouldn't be alive today. It has saved me. Because when you're so much underweight, you feel lightheaded, and the only thing that can pick you up is either chocolate, alcohol, or sugar for
me.
And
I'll get to the alcohol in a second, but I'm also fascinated by, then you describe it in the book, it's called flipping, but it's almost like bulimia in the sense that you were eating a meal and you got so used to actually getting sick almost before the end of the meal that you didn't even at the end have to put your fingers down your throat. You could actually just swallow and do it.
Yeah, just touch your stomach. You know, if you eat plenty and drink plenty, it was easy to do. It's a bit like people eating, you know, like today now, if I like what I'm eating, because I know I don't have a scale to get on, I will eat more than I need, and I feel full, and I keep eating that much that you feel physically sick, you know, that kind of feeling.
Yeah.
So it's easy to get it up, you just pop it out. It was that easy.
But that is so unhealthy.
It didn't affect. I mean, I could name off like Kashif Musin and Steve Cotton. It all started in America. The American jockeys were the ones that educated us to doing it, because at least you can go. Can you imagine not eating at all during the week? You know what I mean? Just picking or whatever. At least if you have a nice meal, you satisfy your mind, then you can get rid of it.
But if you were been so abstemious for food, why then did you consume so much alcohol, and there were times as well, cocaine?
Obviously, you know, when you have a drink, you just, you know, you don't really care.
But hold on, if you have this absolute willpower that you're able to do all of those things to prevent yourself from eating so that you won't put on the weight, why could you not apply the same willpower to alcohol?
I don't know. I just don't know. I wish I had the answer. But I really, you mean your weight, obviously the sweating and the wasting and then obviously getting rid of the food. In the end, I was able to control, like, by doing that, you shrink your stomach and you have to eat less. The more and the less, eat little but often. And it was a way I had in the end for the last couple of years, and I didn't have much problem with it.
The alcohol, though, and drug use, I mean, that did also wreck your career at various times, didn't it?
Yes.
Because you went through a whole load of the best trainers and the best stables you were attached to, but you weren't able to hold on to those positions.
Yeah, to an extent, it's, I don't really know. You mean, I all I wanted to do was ride horses, and I was so obsessed by them. But obviously, you need a release outside of, you know, the... You mean the great days you have, you know. You mean you have good days and you have bad days. And I seem to think that I've probably done too much racing. You mean I was obsessed by it. You mean 7 days a week.
Why? Yeah. Why were you so obsessed? Was it the buzz of actually being in part of a race?
I don't know. Because it was like, I was often asked, you mean, how come you never looked excited? But inner excited, like different to Frankie Dettori, where he loves to jump off, he loves to scream, everybody knows he's there. I often wish I was like that, but obviously inside I was, you know, obviously satisfied. But I used to suppress it, but I don't know why.
How were you when you lost a race?
I often rode three or four doubles or trebles or whatever in a day. And if I got beaten on something that I thought I should have won, that would fry me all the way home in the car. If I
rather
this.
Than the ones you'd won.
Yes, they were the ones who won. That's job done. Is that one race? And I'd be in bad form. That would be eating away at me until I'd understand why.
And what is it about horses? How did you get that love of horses?
I know we grew up on a farm. We had a small farm in Ireland, and livestock. When we had a couple of Connemara ponies, wild. And just jumping on their backs and the thrill of flying through the fields on them, you know, it was just, you know, the buzz I got.
And your son's inherited that as well, has he?
It seems like it, yeah. You know, he's doing everything right at the moment, you know. And he has a...
What age is he now?
He's just turned 18. He's a qualified fitness instructor. So he has something to fall back on if he gets too heavy. But at the moment, he looks as if he's able to control his weight. You know, he's very disciplined.
But would you recommend it to him as a career?
I think it's one of the greatest sports you can be involved in, as long as everything is right. In particular, if you can maintain your weight without having to kill yourself. Today is different. They've put the weights up a lot, you know, and I think it's true. What was I'd say Aidan O'Brien? Aidan convinced him the kids today are much bigger than they were 20 years ago. You know,
and so the sports had to adapt to that.
They had to adapt, and they have done, and they have helped. And we've got dietitians today. You have got so many people there today. Even if you get injured now, you've got the Jack Berry House in England, you've got the Oaksley House, you've here in the Curry, you've got a great apprentice school. You know, there's so much there for the kids and for the younger jockeys that can, the help is there. That wasn't there years ago.
And did you escape without serious physical injury? Because you must have had loads of broken bones and the rest of it over the years from falls.
Never broke a bone in my life.
None?
Never broke a bone. I did sever the main artery, and I severed the nerve in my arm.
Which is pretty serious.
Yeah. But I never broke any bone. It was a miracle, actually, that I was able to get back, because it said it'll never be 100% successful, these operations. But I was lucky enough to overcome it.
You've had some story, some life.
Yes, yeah. And I wasn't really till I was doing this book that I really, really enjoyed it, because I enjoyed it more than, you know, I think going over it than I did when I was doing it, because I think you think it's part of your job when you're doing it, and you don't get to enjoy it, as whereas thinking back, you know. And the guy that wrote this,
Oliver Holt.
Oliver Holt, he's just an amazing guy, and the way he has written it, you know, I think it's, I enjoyed, honestly, I enjoyed a lot of it reading. I know you're saying, I enjoyed it, and it has helped me, you know, to possibly enjoy, because you don't look back and say, oh, like, I won the Guineas 9 times more than anybody else, more than the great Lester Pickett or whatever, you know. You don't think like that, but it's not until you sit down. It's a little bit like the first time I went to Ashiree. I mean, I never thought I had a drink problem. And I go there, and it's not till you have to write down the crazy times you were drinking, the things, the destruction they leave behind, you know. I went in there thinking, I went in there because I just wanted to get away, and I wanted to just kind of like just recharge my body, because there was nowhere you could go, because where you go on holiday, because okay, I'm not going to drink, you know. There's not many places you can go that there's not going to be partying, drinking, whatever around. So I went there and I thought, just to get away. And I couldn't believe the trail of destruction I'd left behind just through drinking. And that always great. And after that, I started using that as I went. I remember a couple of years later, I went there to Cottonwood in Arizona. I went to Betty Ford. It's just to get away, to be on my own, and to look back. And it did help me.
And the book did too.
Yeah.
Look, it's a fantastic read. It's an incredible story. It's an incredible career you had. Kieran Fallon, thank you very much for taking the time to join us on The Last Word.
Thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.